Imagine sitting down to play a game of chess.
Okay.
You know, you've got your standard board, your normal pieces, and, well, a basic understanding of the strategy.
Right, the usual setup.
Yeah, exactly. But then halfway through the opening, your opponent just starts moving their pawns in these strange, completely impossible directions.
Like off the board entirely.
Yes. And then invisible pieces start knocking over your knights. And to make matters even worse, the knight on your own side of the board is a literal, living, breathing horse that absolutely refuses to tell you whose side it's actually on.
Oh man, that sounds incredibly stressful.
Right. And you're playing for absolute keeps, but your opponent is, like, intentionally withholding the rule book.
Well, I mean, that is the ultimate scenario of asymmetric information,
Yeah.
because when one party holds a monopoly on the rules of engagement, the less informed party is basically reduced to purely reactive survival. Every move you make is a gamble, you know,
Totally.
because you can't accurately predict the consequences of your own actions, let alone try to anticipate what the enemy is doing.
Welcome to another deep dive. Today, we are pulling you directly into the center of that incredibly tense, kind of claustrophobic feeling.
It really is claustrophobic.
It is. We are exploring a highly detailed narrative log centered around a group of kids. So there's Agatha, Tom, Alice, and a few others. And they're attempting to survive inside this eerie, cupola-topped Victorian estate called Harcourt Manor.
Which is such a great
Oh,
setting.
it's amazing. But the catch is that this manor sits squarely in the crosshairs of a massive interdimensional proxy war.
Yeah, and the stakes they're dealing with are just profound. They are caught in this crazy web of magical factions, these competing sort of esoteric houses from a realm known as Mirari.
Right, the houses.
And these houses essentially treat the human world as a disposable chessboard. They're maneuvering around the kids while deliberately, you know, keeping them completely in the dark about the overarching objective.
Exactly. So our mission today is to extract the core themes from this struggle. We're going to examine the daily reality of navigating intense information asymmetry.
Which is brutal.
So brutal. We'll look at the crushing psychological burden of leadership when you are, frankly, flying completely blind.
Yeah.
And we'll explore the actual practical mechanics of surviving a political chess match between magical factions that literally refuse to speak to you directly. Okay, let's unpack this.
Well, the narrative plunges us straight into the logistical nightmare of this whole dynamic, starting right in the stables of Harcourt Manor.
Yes, the stables.
Agatha and Tom are trying to solve a very practical problem regarding a magical knight steed.
Named Sohate, right?
Right, Sohate, which belongs to House April. And Sohate is currently housed at a nearby ranch, so they need to know if it's safe to move this magical creature onto the manor grounds without inadvertently triggering a turf war or like a dimensional breach.
Which, I mean, is a massive liability.
Oh,
If you
absolutely.
have an interdimensional horse wandering around your property,
Yeah.
you run the risk of someone accidentally interacting with it and just being teleported straight into a hostile realm.
Exactly. So to assess the risk, Agatha goes to consult Destry.
And Destru is.
Dashre appears to be this massive black stallion, but he's actually a shape-shifting fairy horse.
Right. And they also bring along Kuon, who is this highly perceptive greyhound.
Yeah, so the kids are desperately trying to extract some kind of actionable intelligence from these creatures. What's fascinating here is the intentional hoarding of power through
Yeah,
silence,
yeah.
because Destry doesn't lack the cognitive ability to communicate. He simply refuses to stoop to a human medium. He communicates entirely through like snorts, whinnies, ear flicks, and just incredibly judgmental posturing.
It is so jutting,
He
though.
really is. When Agatha suggests he use a board to point at letters or symbols, Destry just snorts in absolute disgust. He completely rejects the premise of making things easier for the humans.
It was just an agonizing dynamic to watch. You were playing this high-stakes game of charades where the penalty for guessing wrong could be lethal,
Right.
and you aren't even sure if the animal's giving you a clue or if he's just, you know, impatient for the apple Tom is feeding him.
Exactly. And Tom experiences the exact same friction with Kuon, the greyhound.
Oh, the makeshift lie detector.
Yes, because Tom is already deeply paranoid about an operative named Eleanor. So he tries to use the dog to figure it out. He says random words like woods and gets no reaction. But then he says Eleanor and Kuon barks sharply.
It's like, okay, we have a slew, but what does it mean?
Right. The sheer vulnerability of the kids' position is amazing. They are literally surrounded by supernatural entities holding critical strategic data, but they lack the fundamental key to direct communication.
They have to guess.
They have to rely entirely on intuition and observation. It highlights a core tenet of power dynamics, which is that controlling the flow of information is often more effective than controlling physical territory.
Wow, yeah.
By forcing the humans to interpret the meaning of a dog's whine or a horse's stomp, the magical beings maintain total dominance over the narrative.
And that total breakdown in communication creates a really dangerous blind spot.
Oh, definitely.
Because when you can't speak to the factions operating in your space, subtle manipulation eventually just escalates into undeniable physical threats.
It has to.
Right. And the frustration of these guessing games just evaporates the moment Destry and Kuan guide the kids to the edge of the woods. It shifts the conflict from vague hints to hard physical evidence.
Yeah, that discovery at the tree line just shatters any illusion of safety they had. Kuan locks into a pointer stance and they uncover these massive animal tracks in the dirt.
Huge tracks.
And more critically, Agatha pulls tufts of gray and white fur from the bark of a nearby tree.
Which is winter fur. Thick and heavy. And it's completely incongruous with the sweltering heat of the summer forest they're in.
Right. It makes no sense.
It's a jarring intrusion of Murari's atmospheric rules bleeding directly into the human world physical reality. And using this rudimentary system of blinks, Destra confirms that this massive wolf belongs to a rival faction.
House December.
House December, exactly. And the physical manifestation of this threat triggers a massive strategic debate about the portals these factions use to cross over, which the narrative refers to as sieges, like the Siege of Wind or the Siege des Songes.
And this debate around the sieges is heavily informed by a conversation that happens a bit earlier in the text.
With Genji, right.
Yeah, Genji, the Japanese exchange student staying at the manor. He shares a piece of folklore with Tom concerning the Kappa.
Oh, this part is so cool.
It really is. He describes the Kappa as a fearsome, mythical, humanoid creature that stores a bowl of water within an indentation on his head. And Genji explains the underlying mechanic of defeating one. You don't try to out-wrestle the Kappa.
Because you'd lose.
Exactly. Instead, you force it to bow, which spills the water from its head. And once that water is gone, the Kappa loses its supernatural strength entirely.
So Tom immediately internalizes the underlying logic of that folklore. He realizes that when you are fundamentally outmatched in raw power, you don't attack the enemy directly, right?
You attack their infrastructure.
You spill the water. Consequently, Tom proposes this really aggressive plan B. He wants to hunt down the metaphysical gateways, the sieges, and drive iron stakes through them.
Because iron grounds the magic.
Exactly. We learn that iron has this disruptive, grounding effect on the volatile magical currents of Murari. By staking the sieges, Tom intends to permanently collapse the bridges the houses are using to infiltrate their reality.
It is a definitive scorched earth policy.
It is.
But Agatha vehemently opposes the strategy. She points out the mechanical unpredictability of the sieges. Like the Siege of Wind, for instance, isn't a physical door you can just kind of padlock on.
Right, it's just wind.
It's an atmospheric pattern in the grass that only exists when it's active. And more importantly, she brings up the human cost. Staking the sieges would permanently sever their connection to Murari, effectively stranding their friend Rebecca, who is currently operating deep within the magical realm.
I mean, I have to challenge Agatha's stance here, though. Looking at the geopolitical reality of their situation, Tom's aggressive protocol seems entirely justified.
You think so?
Yeah. They just found tracks of a supernatural winter apex predator in their backyard. They are being actively hunted by interdimensional factions that view them as disposable assets. Isn't Agatha's diplomatic approach a profound miscalculation?
Well,
because preserving the infrastructure to save one operative seems like a reckless gamble when it leaves your entire front line completely exposed to a hostile invasion.
I see your point. If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is a textbook crisis management dilemma that intelligence agencies face constantly.
Oh, absolutely.
Do you destroy the enemy's communication network to halt an impending attack, knowing you will instantly blind your own forward operatives?
Right.
Or do you leave the network intact to extract your people, accepting the massive risk to your home soil?
It's a terrible choice.
It is. Tom is viewing the conflict through the lens of a military tactician. You know, neutralize the physical threat at all costs. Agatha is viewing it as a diplomat. Destroying the infrastructure inflicts irreversible damage on your own network of alliances.
Well, the luxury of that theoretical debate vanishes pretty quickly. because following the physical tracks forces Tom and Agatha into an immediate, direct confrontation with the source of the danger.
Yeah, that tracking sequence across U.S. Highway 15 is just an incredible piece of storytelling.
It really is.
It serves as a masterclass in contrasting the mundane fragility of the human world with the looming ancient weight of the magical realm.
The juxtaposition is brilliant. I mean, they are hunting a giant supernatural winter beast, but they're doing it across a stretch of summer asphalt that is so hot the air is visibly waving.
Yeah, Tom actually has to physically carry Kuon across the highway to prevent the Greyhound's paws from burning.
Right. And amidst these terrifying wolf tracks, Tom spots an empty, discarded glass Coca-Cola bottle.
It's so mundane.
And right at the height of the tension, a local farmer named Mr. Jones rolls past in a green Apple Ford pickup truck.
And he makes a joke, right?
Yeah, he makes a casual joke about Tom walking the dog, completely blind to the interdimensional predator lurking just a few feet away.
That mundane interaction really anchors the stakes. It reminds us that this grand, high fantasy proxy war is taking place on top of a very fragile, oblivious human society.
Absolutely.
And the reality of that danger crystallizes when they cross the highway, approach the tree line, and stumble upon little Alice.
Oh, this scene.
She's just sitting in the brush, innocently practicing a spell by burning a piece of paper. And as Tom looks past her, he sees the giant winter wolf standing just 2 feet away, blending into the shadows.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because Tom's reaction defies every single survival instinct.
Oh, totally.
He is an ordinary teenager holding a walking stick against an apex predator.
Mm.
But instead of running or screaming, he utilizes the only weapon he has left in a landscape of asymmetric information.
Which is?
Rigid boundary setting. Tom deliberately crouches down, matching the wolf's level. He openly acknowledges the danger, but he projects this unshakable psychological wall. He tells the massive predator that his group will absolutely not be used as pawns. He demands that if House December or any other faction wants to engage with them, they must drop the espionage and speak to them directly.
It is a phenomenal display of empathic communication and psychological fortitude.
Yeah.
Because the transmission of ideas here doesn't rely on shared language. It relies on the projection of raw intent.
Right. He's projecting.
Tom is transmitting the concept of sovereignty, and the wolf appraises this posturing and acknowledges the boundary. But the wolf's empathic response is a masterful counterattack.
Oh, it's so clever.
It projects an emotional image that essentially communicates, I am separated from my pack, and my house is simply searching for its lost king. But then the wolf deliberately shifts its gaze to Kuon, the dog, and back to Tom, planting a very specific implication. Do not look to the shadows for your manipulators. Look to your own allies.
That is next level psychological warfare right there.
Yeah.
The wolf doesn't even need to physically attack Tom. It just drops a localized EMP on Tom's trust in his own team.
Precisely. The wolf recognizes that in a Cold War built on incomplete data, confidence is the foundational currency.
Wow.
Tom neutralized the physical threat by refusing to be intimidated, so the wolf neutralized Tom's psychological stability by weaponizing his paranoia.
And we see the devastating efficacy of that tactic once the immediate danger passes. The physical adrenaline of the standoff eventually evaporates, and when they retreat to the safety of the Harcourt Manor kitchen, the psychological toll fully manifests.
The setting of the kitchen debrief is so purposefully designed to be a stark contrast to the existential dread of the highway.
It's so normal.
Yeah, they're sitting around a table in the daylight opening sodas, surrounded by the mundane trappings of a domestic safe haven.
But internally, Tom is collapsing. He experiences a violent adrenaline crash. His skin is pale, his hands won't stop shaking, and he's hiccuping uncontrollably.
The hiccups.
Yeah. The seed of doubt planted by the wolf rapidly germinates into this suffocating paranoia, specifically aimed at Eleanor. And we learn that Eleanor is actually an operative known as Rachel of the Golden Hawks, aligned with House October.
And this is where Tom attempts to piece together the fragmented information he possesses, which leads him to a terrifying conclusion about his own agency.
He just begins spiraling. He's convinced that Eleanor has been orchestrating his movements from the very beginning. He recalls how she isolated him, engaged him in seemingly benign conversation, and successfully manipulated his focus.
Yeah, she redirected him.
Right. Instead of searching for the missing king of Mirari, she redirected his attention toward hunting down these terrifying entities known as the Drew.
Yes.
And Tom realizes he has been played, and it just shatters his sense of self-worth.
The concept of the Drew is vital to understanding Tom's despair here, because the Drew are not just random monsters. They are heavily implied to be the metaphysical consequences of human interference.
That's the scary part.
Exactly. When humans interact with the magical realm and attempt to bend or break the ancient rules of the fairy game, that friction manifests the Juru.
They cause it.
They are the physical embodiment of the kid's mistakes. So Tom realizes he was manipulated into cleaning up a mess that his own faction may have inadvertently created.
And this realization drives Tom to vocalize his deepest insecurity. He looks around the kitchen table and explicitly measures his value against the supernatural utility of his friends.
Which is never a good idea.
Never. Alice possesses raw magic. Simon has superhuman speed. Agatha is a trained physical combatant. But Tom views himself as critically flawed because he lacks a specialized skill.
Right.
He admits that he misses the subtle clues the magical factions leave behind. And he concludes that in this high-stakes game, he is the only truly expendable piece on the board.
This raises an important question regarding the toxic burden of leadership, particularly in environments of extreme uncertainty. Tom is experiencing a crippling manifestation of imposter syndrome.
Oh, severely.
He frequently references a squad leader mentality instilled in him by his father. And this doctrine dictates that a leader must be the first into danger, the last to retreat, and must flawlessly anticipate every ambush to ensure the group's survival.
That's an impossible standard.
It is, but Tom has internalized this to an impossible degree. He equates his lack of supernatural ability with a lack of fundamental worth. He believes that if he fails to decipher the invisible rulebook of Mirari, his friends will suffer, and the blame will rest entirely on his shoulders.
It's a stark look at the destructive nature of that archetype. I mean, it's like someone burning out at a job because they're trying to play 3D chess against opponents who won't even share the rulebook.
Right, exactly.
He is exhausting his mental bandwidth, trying to outmaneuver House April, House December, House October, and the Drew simultaneously, all while believing he brings nothing of value to the table.
Yeah.
And Alice actually yells at him for calling himself expendable.
Yeah.
But Agatha recognizes this spiral and immediately intervenes to dismantle that logic.
She grounds him.
She forces him to reframe his perspective away from what he cannot control and toward what he just achieved. She reminds him that he didn't need a sword or a spell to stare down an apex predator on the highway.
He just did it.
He used his own innate resilience.
And Agatha actively redefines their operational structure here. She rejects the military hierarchy Tom is trying to enforce on himself.
Goodness.
Right. She insists they are not a squad requiring a flawless solitary commander. They are a pack.
A pack.
In a pack, the burden of survival is distributed. You don't need to possess every skill. You simply need to trust the overlapping competencies of the group.
So what does this all mean? For you listening, I mean, you might not be hunting interdimensional wolves across hot asphalt or debating the metaphysical mechanics of iron stakes and magical gateways.
Probably not.
Probably not. But the architecture of this conflict is entirely applicable to the complex information landscapes we navigate every day.
Oh, absolutely.
Whether you are dealing with a corporate hierarchy that intentionally silos data, an algorithm designed to obscure its motives, or a negotiation where the other party refuses to show their hand, you are operating in a state of asymmetric information.
Yeah.
The core insight here is that in environments of total information asymmetry, your most valuable asset isn't necessarily acquiring the missing information.
Right.
It's establishing rigid boundaries based on the information you do possess. You don't need the enemy's rulebook to tell them they aren't allowed to cross your borders. Tom survived the woods not by casting a spell, but by establishing an absolute psychological boundary.
And when the sheer weight of operating in the dark leaves you feeling uniquely unqualified or expendable, the solution is not to isolate yourself in a toxic leadership spiral.
Definitely not.
The solution is to lean into the distributed strength of your own pack.
And that concept of distributed strength leads directly to a final lingering implication raised by little Alice at the very end of the kitchen debrief.
Oh, Alice's theory.
Yes. We establish that the magical houses are utilizing the humans as pawns to locate their missing king, right?
Mm.
And that the terrifying Drew are likely a byproduct of humans altering the rules of Mirari.
Right, the consequences.
But Alice flipped the entire power dynamic on its head. She hypothesizes that if human interference is powerful enough to literally manifest monsters into existence, then perhaps the rules of the game aren't as rigid as the magical houses believe.
Which completely recontextualizes the chessboard analogy we started with.
Completely. If these ordinary, non-magical kids possess the metaphysical gravity to spawn new threats and fundamentally rewrite the atmospheric rules of a magical dimension simply by participating in the game,
then who is actually manipulating whom?
Exactly. The houses believe they are maneuvering disposable human pawns. But if the pawns are inadvertently reshaping the board with every step they take, they might unknowingly be the most powerful pieces in play.
It forces a total reevaluation of agency. When the rules of engagement are withheld, the party that survives by improvising often ends up defining the new reality.
It is a phenomenal reminder that refusing to play by a rigged rule book is a strategy all its own. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us. We'll see you next time.